My name is Kevin Cahill. I'm a former deputy editor of the Sunday Times Rich List. I worked in Wapping, and I knew what was going on there. Indeed, at one stage, I reported to my boss at the Sunday Times that the News of the World was engaged in criminal misconduct in Parliament. Yesterday, what's important about yesterday is Prince Harry and Tom Watson got an admission from News UK that the Sun newspaper had engaged in illegal misconduct. The Sun has always denied this, including to Parliament and to the courts. So the admission is that the Sun has committed perjury.
Regularly. Now, the next thing that's important is...
The Metropolitan Police have simply said they've noted what's happened in the court. That is grotesque. The Metropolitan Police are saying, well, yes, we realise... Well, they're not saying that. They've made no... The Metropolitan Police have not admitted that the admission by the Sun is an admission of perjury. There's more as well. The Metropolitan Police last in July said they were investigating a complaint from a Mr. Brown. The Mr. Brown was Gordon Brown, a senior member of the Privy Council, and he complained about what happened to him. But he also complained that evidence at the Sun and the
News and at News International had been suppressed and deleted. The suppression and deletion of evidence
at News International and at the Sun was ordered by Rupert Murdoch. The person who executed his order was his managing editor, Stuart Cupman. And the Metropolitan Police know this. So the attitude of the Metropolitan Police is grotesque.
So, Kevin, have you got any idea why the Met are behaving like this? You would have thought that they would be feeling collars straight away.
Originally, the biggest, the most bribes paid in the United Kingdom by News International or News UK or whatever it calls itself were paid to the Metropolitan Police. And what I am told is it's people who received those bribes who are blocking the investigation. I was unusual down there. I had a parliamentary pass. So I had a completely independent view. And I was conscious of staff from the News of the World and the Sun running around blackmailing people, members of parliament, staff. And it was a trade in blackmail. You know, if you don't give us this, we will report you in the paper. The Sun and the News of the World were used as instruments of criminal blackmail. But that was admitted yesterday. That's what's critical. So it's not an issue of what I knew or who told. The Sun has always claimed, and the Sun's former editor, Rebecca Brooks, told the court that there was no illegal conduct. She said she was running, and I quote, a clean ship. Well, yesterday, News International admitted she wasn't. And Rebecca Brooks must have known what was going on. She was the editor.
So, I mean, I wonder who's most culpable here, because obviously the police are for taking the bribes, but maybe the police are genuinely worried that Murdoch organisation has got dirt on them. And if they were to speak out or to try and actually action this crime, do something about it, that they would find themselves splashed all over the newspapers in some sort of scandal.
Well, splashed all over the courts is much more likely. The suppression of evidence, which is a perversion, is the crime of perverting the course of justice, was ordered by Rupert Murdoch. I was there at the time. And the person who executed Murdoch's orders and suppressed the evidence was Stuart Kuttner, the managing editor of the News of the World. It was that simple. But as I say, I had a pass in Parliament and I would encounter these people running around. You know, and
this is one of the pernicious aspects to all of this, is you've got parliamentary and police who may be investigating crimes being carried out by the Murdoch Empire. They all seem to be under surveillance in a fashion that if they get too close to maybe a prosecution or some sort, they'll be destroyed in the press.
Well, the key thing was the admission made by the Sun, which put the Sun in, you know, it said the Sun has committed criminal acts. And the question you're asking, and I can't answer, is why the Metropolitan Police have said, well, you know, yeah, we took a note of that. But it's more serious than that. In July last year, the Metropolitan Police sent out a press release saying it had a complaint from Mr. Brown. It wasn't Mr. Brown, it was Gordon Brown. It was the Right Honourable Gordon Brown, a senior member of the Privy Council and a former Prime Minister. And he complained about the destruction of evidence. And the Metropolitan Police have not made an investigation.
Well, these are all very, very serious crimes. Perversion of the course of justice, misconduct in public office on the side of the police. But I mean, what we're saying here is, I mean, potentially these are up to life in prison, these sentences for these crimes. But you can't expect the police to investigate themselves, really, and put themselves in prison. I mean, it's like the government. When the government commits a crime, the government is not going to find itself guilty.
No, the full story is much simpler. The full story goes back to last July when Gordon Brown said, these people committed a criminal offence and they have destroyed evidence. And the Metropolitan Police said, yeah, yeah, we got the letter. And they have refused and failed to investigate. This is really serious. This is blackmail inside Parliament.
It's blackmail members of Parliament. And it's perverting, you know, it's lying in court.
Well, some people might say, Kevin, this is the way things have always worked.
In relation to the Metropolitan Police and Murdoch, and Murdoch was the person who authorised the bribes. That's how it has always been. But everybody thought last year that it stopped when Gordon Brown made his complaint. Well, Gordon Brown has not been told that his complaint is not being investigated. I have. But Gordon Brown hasn't.
Oh, right. I mean, you and I were both. Can you just tell us what, you know, when you were at the Sunday Times?
Well, I had a boss. When I shifted to the Insight team, I told him fairly casually that, you know, I was down in Parliament and I saw these people running around blackmailing people. And he joked. He said, do you want your P45 now or this afternoon?
So what years are we talking about, Kevin?
That was in 1988 and 89. Then when I heard, when I left News International and Sunday Times, and I heard the
Metropolitan Police were investigating, of course I phoned up. And I told two police officers what was going on, and they didn't even make notes. The Metropolitan Police have known since 2011 that blackmail was being conducted and lies were being, you know, perjury was being committed in court, and they did nothing. to bring you right up to date, in the last three or four days, the Metropolitan Police have informed me that they are not investigating anything. That's the biggest crime.
Well, we're seeing people being arrested for taking bunches of flowers to the BBC, and yet some of the really, really big crimes not hardly touched at all. Can you just put this all into context a bit, Kevin? Because you know, I was at the BBC in the early 1990s, late 80s. You were at the Sunday Times in a similar time. This was the end of the Thatcher era going on at that point. And, of course, the fallout from Wapping. And Rupert Murdoch really did assert himself. Not only that, we also got the change of the way that newspapers are produced so that the journalists don't have anywhere near as much control over what goes into the paper as they had done previously when these papers were produced in Fleet Street with print unions, etc. So what's the context of all this? Because Rupert Murdoch's had a massive effect on the London media, hasn't he? Which is really our national and international coverage that we get for the whole of the UK, the mass media.
Well, it's worse than that. During Rishi Sunak's time as Prime Minister, Murdoch was a regular visitor at Downing Street. So the biggest crook in the media was received regularly at Downing Street. So presumably there was political interference with the Metropolitan Police from the Prime Minister's office. That's, you know, the only thing that can explain what happened. Apparently Murdoch would
call on the Prime Minister, whichever one it was, and tell him what to do.
But I mean, that wasn't the case back in, say, the 1970s. So what changed with the arrival of Murdoch? I mean, I saw changes in the BBC, definitely, with these people being brought from outside and made senior producers in 1989, etc. Everything was changing, and a lot of the professionals that have been there for many years, actually, you still hear some of them, but they've had to kind of keep their heads down, basically, so that the press isn't really independent anymore, and it's not necessarily accurate. So what did Murdoch, you know, what sort of operation was Murdoch running there? There was also people like Don McCullin, a great photographer. He was sacked by Andrew Neil for Rupert Murdoch at the Sunday Times. There were so many changes from the 1970s through to the late 90s.
Well, Thatcher was a kind of early version of Trump. The law didn't count. All that counted was power and money. But go back to the Boris Johnson appointed the chair of the BBC. I can't remember, he's Sharp. And there was a big fuss about the £800,000 loan that Sharp arranged for Johnson. The rest of the story didn't emerge. Johnson offered Sharp a peerage to continue to attack the BBC and undermine it. And that was the deal. Johnson got in line, as Thatcher had before her with Mackenzie, and offered Sharp a peerage if he'd carry on attacking the BBC and subverting it from inside. I mean, this is serious stuff. But the refusal of the Metropolitan Police to investigate anything is another crime.
Well, it's perversion of the course of justice. You're quite right. I mean, that seems to be what's going on here. Very, very serious crimes at the top of the Metropolitan Police.
Do you remember when Murdoch closed the News of the World? There was actually no statement from Murdoch. There were mumblings in the media that he had done it because he was so ashamed of what the News of the World had done. That wasn't what happened. Stuart Kuttner was deleting and suppressing all the emails, 30 million of them. And he told Murdoch he couldn't finish it, he couldn't do it. There were too many emails to suppress them all, because the emails were between the Whip's offices in Parliament, MI5, the Special Branch, possibly MI6 as well. So in 2011, the suppression man told Murdoch it couldn't be done, and Murdoch closed the paper to stop the investigation. That was the most massive perversion of the course of justice in modern British history. Murdoch closed the news of the world to prevent evidence reaching the Met. Not that getting evidence to the Met meant anything, because nothing happened.
Well, look, the thing is, the Metropolitan Police is not just one person. I mean, do you think there have been attempts in the Met to do any serious investigation when obviously this goes right to the top?
Well, no, this is and this needs to be really sort of probed. Mark Rowley, the current commissioner of the Met, is trying to straighten the mess out. So why is the body under his command refusing to investigate? It's hard on him because I think he probably is trying to straighten out the Met. But somebody inside the Met is blocking everything. And that's probably on instructions from Downing Street. That's where Murdoch was a regular visitor, photographs of him going in there, and no investigation.
Well, I mean, I'm sure the same is true with the Rupert Murdoch empire and Sir Keir Starmer, the present Prime Minister. Now, interesting that he did a similar thing, didn't he, when he was at the Crown Prosecution Service with all of the emails and all of the documents regarding Julian Assange. So he made sure that they were all deleted and suppressed. Now, there's a judicial review of some sort into his decision to delete all this information about this prosecution of Julian Assange in Sweden, I believe it was, and also the links with the United States, because the US were putting on political pressure onto Britain when Starmer was Director of Public Prosecutions to make sure that Julian Assange went down.
Well, the interesting thing is that when America...
Even though, of course, he hadn't committed any crime at all, and he hadn't even been charged in Sweden.
No, this was 100% political. Nothing to do with crimes, criminality, the law, nothing. But with just a few days before, Assange was, the Americans withdrew their case against Assange, the High Court was told that the United States government's case had been brought to court with dirty hands. It's a common law principle of law that if you go to court to ask for a favor, you come with, the concept is called clean hands. And the High Court was told that the American government's position in the court was with dirty hands. They had misled the court. And it panicked them. I can't tell you how the letters reached the High Court, but they did.
You were a soldier in Yemen.
I was.
Many years ago, I suppose, when you were a young whippersnapper, the Trump administration, this new Donald Trump character is now doing 2.0 as president of the empire, they have today or yesterday designated the Yemeni government, Ansarallah government, as a terrorist organization. Which seems to me surprising. It's like this is actually a government. So how come it's a terrorist organisation too? It seems to be rather lining up with Netanyahu. So anyway, I wonder what you make of what's been going on in the Middle East and this decision to turn Yemen into a terrorist organisation.
It's more of the big power politics, and it's more of Netanyahu is assuming that Trump is going to support him totally the same way Biden did. Now, during the war in Gaza, which just reached a ceasefire, conventional open warfare munitions provided by the United States, 500-pound bombs were dropped on people in tents. That's a war crime. And the United States is up to its ears in the criminality of the Netanyahu government. So, you know, lashing out at the Houthis and all that kind of, that's all part of the American support.
Well, that's right. It's funny because they call them the Houthi rebels, don't they? Actually, they're not. They're the government now. And and anyway, President Hadi, who was put in there, was very much that they rebelled against, was very much a US-Saudi puppet. The idea was that he was going to, you know, rule the place with a rod of iron, but the people of Yemen weren't having it. They booted him out. But anyway, what do you make of this whole idea of turning entire countries into terrorist organisations to be proscribed? And if you say something like the Yemenis, the Houthis or whatever, are brilliant in America now, you could be arrested.
Yep.
You see, Trump is supposed to be championing free speech.
The hugest pressure to bring the Nazis to trial in Nuremberg came from the United States. Churchill wasn't, you know, he was neither, you know, he was almost indifferent, and Stalin didn't care. The pressure to create a system of international law came from the United States, which has refused to sign up to the International Court of Justice and refused to admit, you know, the crimes it's committing in Gaza. This is the United States, from becoming a country of law and constitution, has become a country of force. And the law doesn't count, nor does the constitution. Trump is trying to change the American constitution by writing a memo.
I mean, as a former soldier, what do you make of the possibility that some of these, I mean, obviously in World War II, we had the 1946 Nuremberg tribunals you were just referring to. Do you think that those committing war crimes in this genocide and those supporting them financially, materially, politically in Britain and the United States and other countries, do you think they'll ever come to trial?
No. I'm sorry, that's terribly pessimistic, but the refusal of the United States to accept the jurisdiction of the International Court is fairly decisive. It means the United States has retreated to medieval primitivism, you know, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And it won't work. Ultimately, like apartheid in South Africa, the majority of the people in the end will force what happens. But the United States has terrible crimes to answer for the bombing of Gaza.
And on another note, we just had the sacking of the boss of the Competitions and Markets Authority, used to be the Monopolies and Mergers Commission. Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, saying that they're standing in the way of economic growth.
Labour's commitment. Labour's overriding commitment to trying to get the economy of the United Kingdom straightened out. But I've been looking back, I'm analysing, investigating the state of the country's government, the state of the country's economy, handed over in July, is beyond speaking. This country was crippled by July 2024. Nothing was functioning. The Inland Revenue weren't answering phone calls. The Metro Police weren't investigating crimes. The state, but, you know, Labour have said what they're doing, and if I were them, I'd do it much more carefully. What they're trying to do is, if you like, a good thing, but it's how you do it, you know, and allowing people to build houses everywhere and down planning regulations and destroying them is a mistake.
I mean, at the moment, we've got over in Switzerland on his snowy peaks, we've got the Davos crew with the Chancellor over there. I'm not sure if she's trying to do any schmoozing. I think it's probably more the other way around, that she's being pumped for various changes in the law to make her life, to make these big corporate lives easier. But as I was hinting at with this thing about the Competition and Markets Authority, as the government collapses, I mean, let's just put it like that, because as you say, the rule of law not being enforced, the economy in meltdown, various basic facts to do with things like planning and enforcement. There is no planning, really. These big property speculators have managed to get people out of the way here in Bristol, just for example, who have actually tried to enforce the law on planning against them. And it's becoming a bit of a clique. So as the government starts to collapse, as I put it, not you, we've got these big companies over in the multinational corporations, really, over in Davos. So they seem to be running the show.
Well, Tony, since you're one of the very few people who've ever covered this issue, the biggest contractor to our government is Microsoft. Now, Parliament, under oath, in the record, said Microsoft is a criminal corporation. You know this because you covered it. And what's happened? Nothing. Microsoft and the gang of hoodlums associated with it, criminal corporations, are using, and you haven't put your finger on it, but please do, they're using access to the Chancellor to steal all the UK's medical records. That's what they want. So there's a subtext. Not only do they want planning consents demolished, they want free access to the country's medical records. That's what they really want. That's what they're in Davos for. To tell the Prime Minister and the Chancellor that AI will solve all problems. It won't. And if it would solve all problems, why do they have to steal the data? You know, if the enterprise is good and the cause is good, why are they committing criminal theft of data? Nobody's asking that.
I mean, you're painting this picture, which, I mean, it's the first time I've really seen it like this. It's almost like the government is organised crime here. What they're doing is just facilitating criminals to have access to millions of the British population.
Well, one of the most serious things, and it's, again, I haven't written a book or whatever you're supposed to do. I worked in Parliament on and off for 35 years, and I could see the statutory system being corrupted. You know, reams of regulations and reams of so-called law that weren't law at all. Right now, the big drive on the Davos criminals, by the Davos criminals, is to get the medical data. And the last government gave them the go-ahead. It's only an issue, what's this government going to do? I don't think this government even really... The degree to which this government is saying AI is wonderful is only matched by one question. If it's so bloody wonderful, why are these companies stealing the data? Why are they committing crimes to get the data? And that's what they're doing. And they have been, the last government, you know, put stuff on the statute book that was corrupt to enable them to do it. So, you know, what this government is doing is the same with the planning laws.
Now, just before Christmas, Dominic Cummings put out an interesting hour-long or so talk at some sort of London think tank, where he suggested that AI is already running the government. He was saying that he thinks quite a lot of this policy is created by multinational corporations. It's translated into AI, and actually maybe even some of the speeches read out from the auto queues by government ministers are written by AI. Certainly the ministers, he was painting a picture of them being simply public relations people who, when they go into a meeting with the civil servants have already decided what they've got to say, and they don't really have much of a say at all.
No, this is, I mean, the level of PR propaganda in favour of AI is its own story. You can see what's happening. You can see where it's coming from. But nobody is saying, if everything is that good, why are they stealing the data? Why can't they get it legitimately? And the answer is, if people knew why they were stealing the data, they wouldn't agree to it. That's simple. Who is going to agree that Microsoft can steal their data so they can corrupt our government?
Anyway, look, Kevin, you're also very well, I say very well, you are quite well known for your books about who owns the world, who owns Ireland, who owns Britain. Can you just say a bit about those and what information is in there?
The most important information was in Who Owns Britain, because for the first time ever, the actual landholders were named. So there was a big reaction to that. And the second thing was, the bureaucracy here in this country suppressed the second doomsday. And that was, you know, but it's funny, I had an exchange with the land registry this morning. They have refused to confirm that freehold is a form of leasehold. It doesn't mean ownership. And they have refused to confirm properly. Today, in a press, in a email, that the Crown is still the owner, or claims to be the owner, of all land in Britain. And remember where you put your finger on, the value of the Crown estate. Do you remember the first thing that the coalition government of 2010 did? They gave ownership of the Crown estate to the Crown. They restored it. It hadn't been cancelled, but it had, you know, it had become confused. So they resolved the confusion. They, coalition government, gave the Crown estate to the Crown. And as you put the figure, 21 billion. The Crown is beyond immensely rich, and nobody mentions it.
The main thing to do with land, which has been in the news the last few months, is of course the farmers being asked to pay inheritance tax. Now, they, you know, a lot of critics will say, "Well, sorry, farmers, but your inheritance tax is far less than people are paying on houses." And you know, there's also this whole issue of more and more, because of the property bubble, more and more people, just ordinary London homes, are being caught in the as if they're some sort of mansion, you know, being caught by inheritance tax. But what do you make of this move? Because the main thing is that if your land is owned by a corporation or by a trust or some other similar body, you don't pay inheritance tax. It's only if this is your own personal private thing. I mean, surely it's, isn't it, you know, this, there's something rather peculiar going on here, because this land, as many of these farms have been passed on for several generations, sometimes, you know, great-great-grandparents' land. And the farmers are thinking, hang on, you're not taking my great-great-grandparents' land off me. So anyway, what do you make of this whole inheritance tax land issue that the government has decided we're going to start taking land off of individual families and people, and actually making it easier and not taxed if it's owned by corporations?
No, the government isn't taking land off anyone. That's the first mistake. The reaction has been orchestrated by the CLA, Country Landowners Association, who are the big landowners behind the National Farmers Union.
Yeah, but they're not really paying this tax, are they? Most of these big landowners have got their land in trust.
Well, a lot of them have it registered offshore and in trust, so they'll never pay tax. They have conned the smaller farmers into shouting and screaming and driving tractors to Westminster. It's a con by the big landowners. No system of taxation has ever touched them in this country. And that's, they see the government as inching towards cancelling like offshore ownership in trust and everything else, so that the people who actually hold the land pay the tax. And the farmers are making a terrible mistake. The level at which some kind of tax becomes payable is about 3 million. Now, most ordinary homeowners who have no assets like that, and they pay 40% tax on their, you know, terraced house. This is another stunt and a con, you know, to manipulate the system. And I think farmers are making a dreadful mistake. The public will have no sympathy for people who don't pay tax till their assets reach 3 million. 3 million is a lot of money to ordinary people. And people driving tractors to Westminster are gaining no favours in the end. They're making a dreadful mistake.
Well, if you talk to the farmers, as I've interviewed some of them, they will say, Kevin, actually, we are only turning a profit. We're not turning a profit every year. They're fairly marginal. So we're talking here about farms round about maybe 300 to 500 acres. And they're saying that it's actually, particularly with the increase in energy costs, and all this new legislation that's coming in around so-called green, you know, the cow fart tax and things like this, that they're having to take land out of production. They're being told to do that in order to keep getting any kind of subsidy. So if you talk to those individual farmers, they will tell you that they're only just about able to make a profit. The people who really run farming, they tell me, are the supermarkets.
No, farming is producing food, and you have to sell the food you produce. Getting down into the argument about whether you make a profit this year or last, that's business. Are you there, Tony?
Yeah, but you look at the energy costs. They're talking at, for example, about three, you know, energy bills going up to three times higher because of the massive hikes in electricity, gas, and this sort of thing.
Yeah, no, I mean, all these arguments are valid. But like I say, when you boil it down, what kind of tax, inheritance tax, is your small freeholder of a terraced house going to pay 40%? And they get no subsidies. You know, this is, why should one particular form of business, farming, be subsidised? What about my job or your job?
Well, because farmers are, brought us civilisation. You know, thousands of years ago, if we haven't got a secure food supply, the whole of the society will collapse. But what about this? The main beef I have with you, Kevin, here, is that it's okay to own this so long as you do it through a trust or a corporation, and you don't get taxed. But if you own it personally, you do. So what's happening is land is being transferred from individuals to corporations.
No, there are all sorts of things like that going on. They're tracked a bit in the books. But one of the biggest cons was the large landowners keeping their land registered outside the country. You know, I think the basic point you would make, and I hope I would make, is that a level playing field for everybody. If you've got big assets, you pay X tax. If you have lesser assets, you pay less. But you don't, you know, impose 40% tax on homeowners. Mm. This is the thing. And I mean, going back to my military background, we very nearly lost World War II because of the U-boats. That was very close. The Battle of the Atlantic very nearly sunk us, and which is a way to emphasize how important farming is. You know, it's part of national security. And so farming should be supported and everything, but an ordinary worker, you know, somebody who works in an office or a factory, and they live in a small, a terraced freehold house, why should they pay 40% tax? Why shouldn't they get a subsidy? You know, it's level playing field stuff, dead simple.
Well, look, I know you've been writing about computers pretty much all your journalistic life, actually, over the years. And you've been there really since the start, you know, when a computer was an amazing thing to have, supposedly, in the 1970s and 80s. And I just wonder what you make of, finally, Kevin, today on AI, because I noticed quite a lot of material, whether it's, I mean, this is journalistic material. I'm talking about reading through an article, even something as simple as a weather forecast, that sort of thing. AI now seems to be writing a lot of this material, but there's nothing on the side to say this was written by AI, is there? There doesn't seem to be any kind of understanding of the importance of letting people know whether something, what this suggests to me is the idea is to actually do away with journalists and just simply have AI writing everything for the public and making out that it's some sort of critique, but actually, anyway. So, what do you make of the ability of AI to actually completely get rid of journalism?
It's extremely threatening. But what about the capacity of AI to get rid of people, as well as journalists? In 1974, which is a long time ago, I had a choice between two kinds of computer-aided diagnostic systems in medicine. I had to make a decision which way to go. AI didn't work, and I don't think it still does. The doctor I was working with myself used a thing called Bayesian principles. Bayes was an English mathematician who was a specialist in statistical analysis, and that works. But AI, when we tried to use AI in 74 to do computer-aided diagnostics, it didn't work.
Yeah, but it's come on masses. It's almost as if these tech giants have invested masses of money in AI because they want journalists and everyone else out of the way. They just want the computers to do everything.
Around the world, yeah. It's megalomania. And the megalomania starts in a company called Microsoft, and they know it. Well, there's a bit of news at the end. The High Court is considering a case, as you know, against regulators here who've done nothing, the Information Commissioner, the police, and the 9 criminal corporations. That's an ongoing case in the High Court. Now, it's not been reported by anybody except yourself.
Okay, Kevin Carhill, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, Tony, goodbye.